Welcome to another edition of On the Line, a podcast that brings to light stories from BC's rich heritage of labor history. I'm your host, Rod Mickleborough. In this episode, we celebrate the life of Tetsuro Buck Suzuki, who spent his life advocating for the West Coast fishing community, first as a young liaison between Japanese Canadians and an industry dominated by whites, then as a strong trade unionist, and finally as an early environmental activist fighting to protect fish habitat. You will hear him in an interview conducted and recorded by the City of Richmond in 1976, the year before he died. We also spoke with Lorene Oikawa, who was related to Buck on her father's side and who has carried on his legacy of trade unionism and social activism. The first Japanese immigrants arrived on the West Coast in 1877. By 1900, more than 4,000 farmers, fishermen, and laborers from Japan had settled here. Buck Suzuki's father and other family members arrived in 1906 and took up residence on Oikawa Island in the south arm of the Fraser River. Buck was born there in 1915. By the time he was nine, he was already fishing. As he grew older, he developed a capacity for working with people and became a spokesperson for the Japanese community in Steveston. But all that came to an end after Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. Canada joined the United States in declaring war on Japan and moved quickly against its peaceful Japanese-Canadian residents on the West Coast. They lost their houses and other possessions, including their prized fish boats, evicted from the coast and interned in grim, rudimentary camps in the BC interior. Before detailing the impact of internment and the war on Buck Suzuki, however, a bit of background. Here he is talking about the early days of fishing on the West Coast and what it was like for Japanese Canadians like himself. This is from his interview with the City of Richmond's Oral History Program.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the early days of the Union and how the Union came into being and your involvement in it.
Well, I noticed that the Union has been the effort to organize has been very strong in the Steveston area from a way back. Firstly, they were, they were divided into ethnic lines, especially with the people of Japanese origin on one side and the natives and the others on the other side sort of idea. And there was, for the companies, it was a very good thing. You would just say second, and one would go and smile at the other, or they would never pull together. And what made it worse later on in their early efforts was that somewhere along the line, they began to deprive this one ethnic group, the Japanese, of certain rights, and this weakened them. And when you weaken a person, well, then he's not very good for pulling together anymore.
The coast was divided into regions, and licenses were given out for each area. But pressure from non-Japanese restricted where the Japanese could fish.
The companies, they didn't care one way or the other. But the pressure from the citizens made it so that the politicians thought it was a dandy, and they got on this bandwagon. And they really blew it up, you see. And we didn't know any better. That is, when I say we, the persons of Japanese origin, they'd always been living in ghettos, segregated, because that was the general attitude of the time. And when you do that, you don't know what the other person is thinking about. A lot of those people in Steveston and other places where there were Japanese ghettos or Chinese ghettos, those people were honorable people. They intended to follow the law and respect the law, and they thought that was all that was necessary. But it wasn't so. It was a question of social contact. The problem of understanding somebody else's customs, religion, everything else, And when you don't understand that, in the old days, the majority had very little patience with those people, and as a result, there were further discrimination, and until finally, in the end, they decided they cut the Japs completely out of the industry. I think the year that they cut them was in 24. Mm-hmm. So anyway, this really segregated them from the rest, and the cry was, all right, we started on the Japs, now let's finish the job. Mm-hmm. But at that time, the company suddenly seen that the fishing power in those days, and in the hand-pulling days, the experienced ones were growing. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't always a level of the same level of license applicants each year. In other words, certain years when there weren't too many fish, well, then you'd have a great big drop in the normal Canadian application.
Right.
The only ones that you had to rely on were the Japanese, who prized their license. It was a precious thing. They, you know, so they hung on to it. They became experts in the fishing game. Nevertheless, when they became experts, and then they were subject to more prejudice. Mm-hmm. Damn son of a guns must be using some other methods or illegal methods, or they work too hard, or they can survive on rice and fish and all, or you name it. What they couldn't think of. The only good, well, finally it ended up, the only good Jap is a dead Jap. This is how far it went. So, anyway, this wasn't just one person. It was everybody.
Various unions competed to represent the fishermen, but race continued to be a factor. Suzuki was asked about the BC Fishermen's Protective Association and whether it was mostly for white fishermen.
Mostly white fishermen.
Yes, no, all white. As a matter of fact, they wouldn't allow any Japanese in the membership. Then there was the Pacific Coast Fishermen's Union, which was a sort of a follow-up from the old Wobbly people and the Fishermen and Canoe Workers Industrial Union. I attended many of their meetings in the early 1930s, you know, and I know their thinking and everything. They were a bunch of dreamers, you see, at that time. Very practical dreamers, but still they would be classified as radicals and real dreamers in those days, by society in general. I think they were on the right track insofar as organizing is concerned, and they finally culminated in the Pacific Coast Fishermen's Union, which went together with same boat, Salmon Purse Seiners Union, and they formed the United Fishermen's Federal Union, which again changed its name to United Fishermen and Allied Workers Union, which is the most dominant union here in the industry now, you know, embracing all fishermen and shore workers.
But conditions remained difficult for Japanese fishermen, no matter how much Suzuki involved himself in the union.
What was your involvement in the union? Were you...
Well, in those days, I tried my best to be a sort of a liaison person, because in one, you were not allowed to go in, you know, become a member in the Pacific Coast Fishermen's Union. In the other, you were sort of semi-welcome, provided you towed the line and did as you were told, sort of idea. And you were a good man that would stand by all that they came up with. And so, when you looked at it, if you joined one, you antagonized the other. Where do we go? The companies, for one thing, didn't like the idea of us joining the Pacific Coast Fishermen's Union. Why were we afraid of the company? Because most of the Japanese people, especially in Steveston, were subservient to the companies. Everything they owned, except their boats and nets, their houses, their tire facilities, everything else, was owned by the companies. And they each year they were advanced enough to, you know, tie them over in the wintertime, and then they start again in the spring, sort of idea. So they had no choice but to not be principled, but just be, you know, straddling both sides. What can we do? Mm-hmm. No politician wanted to help us for the simple reason we were without franchise. We were second-class mm-hmm. citizens at that time, or third-class citizens, whatever you want to say. We weren't worthwhile speaking for. So they just really, instead gave us the boot.
Oh. hark to the song of the sockeye, like a siren's call of old. When it gets in your blood, you can't shake it. It's worse than the fever for gold. There's a hole in BC's coastline. Rivers Inlet is the place that I mean. And it's there that you'll find the old-timer, also the fellow that is green. And the boats head for there like the sockeye. Some are a joy to the eye, while others are simply abortions. They ought to be left high and dry. But when the season is over, and we think of the money that we've made, we'd have been better off to have stayed on shore, no matter how low we were paid. So hark to the song of the sockeye, like a siren's call of old. When it gets in your blood, you can't shake it. It's worse than the fever for gold.
Internment was the coup de grace. In addition to being forced into camps, the boats belonging to Japanese fishermen were seized and sold off for a pittance. But Buck Suzuki managed to escape the worst of it. He had contacts at local naval headquarters and got a sense of what was coming. So he moved quickly to sell his boat before it was confiscated.
I sold that boat. I knew what was coming, so I just sold it as soon as I could. I tried to tell the other people in Stevenson immediately after the boats had been impounded. All their fishing gear in their boats, I said, I can distinctly remember, and I must have been very, very youngish looking, because I remember going to this meeting, and there was just every person of Japanese origin that was in the fishing industry was at this hall in Steveston. Mm-hmm. And I spoke to them in my broken Japanese and told them, you better sell your boat, you better sell your net, you're not going to go fishing anymore. But they had the idea that they had, there's all kinds of people, you know, who were taking money from some of the Japanese and saying that, look, we're going to go to Ottawa. We got friends in Ottawa. We got politician friends. We'll see that you go back out again. And here I was bucking this sort of thing.
Right.
You see, I knew that it was impossible. I had been, working on this thing, studied the psychology of the Canadian public.
Growing up, Loreen Oikawa always referred to Suzuki as her Uncle Buck, although technically he was an older cousin. While she recalls him being around, she doesn't remember him telling stories about his work. He was busy and away a lot. Not until Loreen became active in the BC Government Employees Union did she begin to hear about his trade unionism. That prompted her to begin her own research. In an interview, she reflected on the tendency of families not to speak about the cruelties and racism they experienced.
In fact, later I found out too, my mom's family, they were given 24 hours notice, weren't told how long they're going to be gone, where they're going, told to pack whatever you could carry. And then my mom's family were in Cumberland on Vancouver Island. It's north part of Vancouver Island. And it was used to be a mining community. Anyway, they were shipped from there. They were shipped to Hastings Park, which the federal government had taken over. And then families that got there were forced to separate again. So children and the mums and the grandmas went to the livestock barns. Teenage boys went to another building. Men went to another building. And they weren't allowed to, if you can imagine, if you're a teenage boy, you're not allowed to speak to your mom, your dad, anyone. You're separated into these buildings. And they lived there for sometimes several weeks before they were shipped out to a camp. And so that's the experience of my mom's side of the family. And then my dad's side, along with my Uncle Buck, right, were already in Vancouver. So they weren't shipped to Hastings Park. They were shipped directly to the camps. But yeah, it's really hard to, I think most people are really hard to understand. But if you think of it, you're in your home, you're safe. You have all your stuff, your belongings. And if you can imagine that all of a sudden there's a banging on the door and there's police there saying you don't belong, we're gonna move you out, take what you can carry. It just boggles your mind. Like, I don't even know what I would think.
It's not well known that even after the war ended, Japanese Canadians were not allowed to return to the West Coast for another 4 years. By then, as Lorene Oikawa recounts, many had no interest in returning.
Sometimes I think because families don't talk about the internment, for example, just because the whole kind of what I call philosophy is that it happened, it was bad, but let's move on. They were forced to rebuild their lives, to work, to get money. So not a lot of people could come back to the West Coast. But this huge part of our history is not as well known because families just didn't talk about it. They worked hard. They rebuilt their lives. They just pushed forward and wanted to make a better future. So I know for my family, I didn't know about it. It was only till later. And that's kind of the same thing with my Uncle Buck. We didn't talk about things.
Meanwhile, despite the shameful way he and other Japanese Canadians had been treated, Buck Suzuki tried to enlist in the Canadian Army. Yet even then, he was rejected because he was Japanese. The British Army, however, was not so fussy. They were fighting Japan in the Pacific and recruited Suzuki for vital intelligence work. He spent 2 years with the British as an intelligence officer in India and Singapore, where he helped to investigate war crimes after Japan surrendered. Lorene Oikawa explains.
So World War II, and Canadians of Japanese ancestry wanted to show again their loyalty, and they were rejected. And so at one point, my uncle Buck, the British Army, said, well, we want people. We want skilled people, etc. So, he got recruited by the British Army. The Canadians said something about loaning or whatever. So my cousin laughed and said, well, that was because the British Army said, we'll take the Canadians, Japanese Canadians. And then to save face, that the Canadian Army just said, oh, well, they're on loan to the British Army, is the way my cousin put it. That's how he became involved with the British Army.
When he returned to Canada in 1947, Suzuki simply ignored the ban on Japanese Canadians returning to the West Coast. He boarded a train for Vancouver.
Perhaps you could tell us a bit about what it was like when you returned after the war?
Well, in my case, there was no trouble at all. Absolutely no trouble. I was a returned veteran. I'd just come back from overseas, and I just stayed for a little while in southern Ontario where my wife and child was, and then took a notion to come up to British Columbia. And it wasn't because there wasn't a job for me or a house or anything. They were very, very nice in Ontario. They were going to get me a house. The jobs were all over for me and everything, you know. Mm-hmm. But the statements being thrown around at that time was that no Jap will ever be allowed to come back to the coast.
Right.
So I said, well, is that so? What are you going to do about it? And this was within 10 days after I had landed in Canada. I had friends out here, so I just come right out here on the train. I still had my military pass and everything else, and came right into Vancouver, and I wasn't going to beat about the bush. I went straight into the, what we call the Japanese, Security Commission headquarters, where the RCMP were still keeping statistics. So I went over and I knew the man in charge, and I went up and talked to the man, and I said, hey, Blackie, I'm back. And he just squirmed and squirmed something fierce, you know, because I knew damn well that there was no Japanese person that was supposed to come in here without a permit. So I said, hey, Blackie, after a while I stayed there and he chewed the rag about everything, and he was squirming, since he, give me that slip of paper, and I said, give me a permit right now. He said, you know, he said, I don't want to get you in Dutch. He didn't say a damn thing, he just shoved the paper over to me, you know. And I signed that requesting permission to come here. And, look around. He said, what are you going to do? And I said, I think I'll go look for a job, Blackie. So I came out here, and I guess as a veteran, I could have, I brought my wife and child out here. Oh, the housing was something fierce. There's no houses. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I finally found a couple of rooms in Vancouver. I got a job longshoring. And then I decided, well, everything's free and easy now, so I might as well go and see how fishing is like. Mm-hmm. So I came out here and started fishing. It wasn't that easy. I just went directly to the company that I used to fish for before. I said, see, I was just wondering if I couldn't get you to back me up to go fishing.
I don't want your millions, mister. Well, I don't want your diamond rings. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again. Well, I've worked to build this country. Well, you lived a life of ease. Now you've stolen all that I built, mister. Why, my children, they starve and freeze. I don't want your millions, mister. And I don't want your diamond rings. All I want is the right to live, mister.
So Buck Suzuki wound up fishing again without much trouble. But other Japanese Canadians who wanted to get back into the industry weren't so fortunate. Racism remained strong in the industry, and they were kept ashore. It took a dramatic intervention by Homer Stevens of the United Fishermen and Allied Workers Union to smooth the waters for their return. Buck Suzuki.
In those days, it didn't cost too much. You didn't want anything much, you know. All I wanted was a roof over my head and a boat. So he got me a place down the road here a bit, an acre of land, a float house, fishing equipment, a boat, and a bunch of nets for $2,000. So that's the way I got started. But as far as I was concerned, there was no trouble. But the people in Steveston, they had a lot of trouble. They had the right to go and obtain a fishing license for the first time as free people. They had licenses in their back pocket. None of the companies wanted them. Didn't want them for the simple reason that the fishermen said, we will not have any Japs fishing out of this country. If you do, we're leaving. Or if you do, we're going to not have out of them. That sort of thing. The first people to go and take them on, take anybody of Japanese origin on outside of myself, down in Steveston, was J.H. Todd and Company. They took a couple of boys. Then one day I was fishing up here, and my cousin was fishing. We were both returned men. And we were fishing down here, and these two men come crying up. And I wondered what in the world had happened. The whole gang in Steveston, the fishermen, chased them away from the dock, chased them all the way up river, told them to get out of here and don't you come back here again. So these two against all of Steveston in those days, well, they didn't know what to do. Well, I've never seen a man so mad and crying at the same time, but he come up there and I said, well, look, you just take it easy. So I picked the phone up and I called Vancouver, quit fishing, called Vancouver, and I talked to Homer Stevens, who I'd known very well. And I said to Homer, I said, this is what happened. Well, he says, leave it to me. Leave it to me. He says, I'll look after it. So he went straight down to Steveston, called a meeting, and he really roasted them, you know, on principle.
Head of the union at the
time?
Yes,
he was secretary treasurer of the union at that time. And he roasted them, really give it to them, you know, from a philosophical point of view, as a trade unionist. So anyway, they got together, and then Steveston local decided that, all right, if any person of Japanese origin wants to come fishing on his own, we'll do everything we can to go and set up a committee to protect him from the rowdies. That's fine. And then right away, immediately, the Steveston canneries, especially B.C. Packers, people who had been shunning the Japanese and telling everybody else, no, we won't have no Japs around, we'll never have any Japs. They grabbed every person that had a license in his back pocket and had been hanging around. They just phoned them up and called the whole works in. See? It wasn't the love of the Japanese or anything. No. They loved the production at that time. And as soon as B.C. Packers did it, Nelson's had already started in the Skeena River area. And then Canadian Fish was left out cold, so they just even went on a recruiting drive to see if they could entice the Japanese from the prairies in eastern Canada to come out here and fish, which was something I objected to very strenuously. It's one thing for people to want to come, but to go and recruit them and almost cause a situation, you know, where like what we knew before the war, that I'm dead against it. But then nobody less money talks, and this is the way it's been. But I've been in a position to guide these people, to work together with the union, to work within the union. Step by step, I shed the Japanese people, you see. Not because I wanted to shed them, but I realized that they had to stand on their own feet. Mm-hmm. But what did I do with my energy? I had excess energy at that time and on those things. I started to take over general, you know, union work.
Right.
Not that I was paid or anything, but, you know, took part in all the regular things. And
did you help organize people? And
organize people and organize meetings and take care of strikes and, you know, everything else. Fisheries. My main job was taking part in fisheries regulations and international law fisheries.
I see.
Yeah.
When you were busy with the union, were you also fishing at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Could you recall any conflicts or outright confrontations you had because of your union activities with the companies?
They're very subtle. You know, they would never do that. I got along splendidly with them, right? But I guess they found out that I was one of those characters that when I said no, I meant no, and if I said yes, well, I would try and make sure that we kept our word one way or the other. So I got along fine, but I knew which side of the bread the butter was on. And the nicest part of it was when we had trouble in 1967 and the president of the union and the secretary treasurer were thrown in jail. That's the year that they asked me to take over. So I took over for over a year. And then I, once they come out of jail, I fished for a while and then went back again as welfare director of the union for British Columbia. Until I couldn't move anymore.
As if all that wasn't enough, Suzuki became more and more concerned about the health of the salmon fishery and the threats to it from environmental degradation. Lorene Oikawa.
And then later on, although years ago, he also then became involved in what we would term as the environmental movement, but there really wasn't a movement at that time. It was basically he was saying, we're dumping stuff in the water, which was typical garbage, pollutants. They're poisoning our fish habitat, poisoning fish, but that's also poisoning us. And so I know that was a hard battle because at the time people just would have thought, why are you talking about this? This is something we do. Why are you worried about it? But he persevered and continued. And I'm glad he was one of the people because that's a huge concern for us today as well.
Buck Suzuki died in 1977, but his name lives on with the T. Buck Suzuki Environmental Foundation, established by the United Fishermen and Allied Workers Union in 1981. as a legacy of his tireless work to preserve fish habitat. The goal of the foundation is to protect BC's marine ecosystems, fisheries, and ocean-dependent communities. Says the foundation's website, "Our strength lies in a collaborative, socially minded, and flexible approach to environmental activism, pioneered by our namesake, T. Buck Suzuki." Buck Suzuki had a huge impact on both fishermen and the waters off the West Coast, but he also had a personal impact on Lorene Oikawa.
It was made, Japanese Canadians were made invisible. They were disappeared. Buildings, everything that they contributed to communities, all their work. And so that's the other important is we have to remember what's the possibilities. What was it like? What we've lost? Certainly some things we've gained, but also to recover some of the beauty, some of the nature. And then also just to remember all the contributions, like the fishers, all that they did, and the Japanese Canadian fishers and their role. And that was one of the amazing things about my Uncle Buck, too, because he was fishing since he was 9 years old. He was fishing. So I can't imagine, but as a nine-year-old, I wasn't fishing or doing anything like that. And then I think he was 15 years old. He was really bright, and he could speak Japanese and English, and he knew a lot political, and he knew he was good with people. He was one of the founders of the Japanese Canadian Citizens League, and he was doing great work to try to build the relationship between the fishers. And he was, and you know, who knows if they hadn't been interned and all that, who knows what might have happened. But anyway, that kind of all blew up at that point. And then he came back and then he worked again, and he brokered a deal to make it so that Japanese Canadian fishers would be accepted. And then he worked alongside his fishing brothers, because it was mostly, if not all, men at the time. And he worked with them to fight for the rights of workers, fishers. But just to say that very proud of that legacy, and also want to ensure it continues beyond me, and that we always remember these stories and ensure that we do not do what we've done before of take away people's rights and jump on actions that are so divisive, and also to remember our environment, because our environment is us. We all have to have that harmony of animals and fish and all of us living together, because we only have one earth. I maybe didn't know as much before, but as I learned more and more, I know that I'm carrying on the work of many good people, not just my uncle, many good people who've done a lot of work to fight for the rights of workers in the labor movement, et cetera. So I want to honor them by continuing that work and make sure the stories are never forgotten.
Tatsuro Buck Suzuki was a remarkable person. He could teach us much today about living a principled life, overcoming adversity, and fighting for justice at a time when none of that was easy. I hope you've enjoyed our tribute to him.
Hold the fort, for we are coming.
Thanks to the other members of the podcast collective, Donna Sakuda and Patricia Weir. Patricia did much of the research and the interview with Lorene Oikawa. The music, appropriately, is by George Hewison, a former president of the United Fishermen and Allied Workers Union. John Mabbitt put everything together. And I'm your podcast host, Rod Mickleborough. We'll see you next time on The Line.